and day comes. We step out of the shade of flame and unafraid. The new dawn balloons as we free it. For there is always light, if only we are brave enough to see it. If only we are brave enough to be it. Let us speak together our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another. Today's service closes out our January theme of imagination. This morning, we will think about and talk about imagination and change, about beginnings and endings and full circles. Today's message, along with our Time for All Ages story, is delivered by Felicity Shoulders. She describes her presentation as how the end of the world isn't the end of the world. Today marks kind of a full circle for Felicity, who, by the way, happens to be a very fine writer of speculative fiction. Her latest story, being published in Asimov's Science Fiction magazine in early February. Felicity came to WOOF for the first time on the Sunday following the 2016 presidential election. And we are so happy she chose to stay.
Once upon a time, there was a drought. The rain stopped, and it just didn't start again. Jen and Joe's farm was on the edge of the desert, and as the sand moved in with the dry wind, they decided to move away north. They packed up everything they had and trudged away. They drank the dew that settled in their big empty cook pot every night and ate just a little every day of last year's dried grain. Even so, they had run out of food and strength when they reached a creek and a little village next to it. The village was dusty, and the stream looked like it used to be larger, but the hills around it were sort of green, and Jen and Joe were eager to see if there was any food. "Please," said Jen at the first house, "we are traveling from the southern desert. Could we share your meal for a day's hard work?"
"Meal?" said the frightened farmer. "I have no meal. There's a drought, and my crops have not grown this year." And he slammed the door.
"Excuse me, kind madam," Joe said at the next, larger house. "I don't suppose you might spare a morsel for two tired travelers. We know many fine songs and will sing sweetly for our snack."
But the lady of the large house snapped, "We have no morsels, not a thing to eat. I have been gnawing the same bone for a week," and shooed Joe off.
It was the same throughout the town. The inn said, "No food," and every house's cabinet was claimed to be empty. Every door was shut.
"Joe," Jen said, "I think we must find a way to walk on without food. Perhaps we can drink ourselves full of this creek water and try to roll to the next town."
"Nonsense," Joe said. "I will tell you what we'll do."
So Jen and Joe collected fallen firewood and half-filled their cooking pot with water from the creek. Then they waded into the creek, holding up stones, tapping them, and discussing them, observed by suspicious eyes from the shuttered village houses. At last they chose a big flat stone, dark and well smoothed by the creek in its wilder, deeper days. Then they started the fire under their pot and plop, threw the stone into the water. Joe and Jen sat down on stumps, one on either side of their pot, and sang back and forth about the glorious dinner they would have by and by. The innkeeper crept out of his inn and came close to listen.
"Whatever are you doing, travelers?" he asked. "What is that you're making?"
"Why," said Joe, stirring the boiling water with a big spoon, "we are making stone soup."
"And what, pray tell, is stone soup?"
"It's the most delicious, nutritious, and flexible meal you ever had.
The only problem with it is that it takes so long to cook the goodness out of a stone into the broth. We will be waiting some time, but when our soup is finished, sir, you are welcome to share it. The innkeeper was very curious to learn the exotic cuisine of the South Desert and agreed to taste the concoction.
"Especially as I have no dinner of my own," he remembered to say.
"It's only too bad we have no herbs or garlic," Joe sighed.
"Indeed," Jen agreed.
"Stone soup is the thickest, best soup in the world, sticks to your ribs, but it is better with some spices."
"Why, I have some garlic left, and some herbs, too," admitted the innkeeper. "I do not count those as food, exactly," he explained, and hurried away to get the spices.
When they were added to the pot, stone soup smelled so savory that soon the lady in the fine large house came out to find out what was cooking.
"It is a foreign dish, stone soup," whispered the innkeeper.
"Who ever heard of such a thing? Is it tasty?" asked the lady.
"It is greatly tasty, and we are most happy to share," Jen offered grandly.
"I only wish we had some meat to balance the natural strength of the stone flavor," Joe sighed.
And what do you know? That lady's old gnawed bone proved to be a long string of sausages, only slightly dry from the weather. They made the broth thick and brown. The farmer came out to see what all the hubbub was, and upon being asked to share in such a meal, offered up a few wizened carrots. The next farmer had, what do you think he had?
Zucchini.
Yeah, that's right. And the villager after that had grown, what do you think?
Potatoes.
And by the time Joe pronounced the goodness had been cooked out of the stone, it was the fullest, richest soup anyone in the village had ever tasted. It was full of garlic and thyme and basil. It had squash and barley and potatoes and sausages. It had spinach and tomatoes and onions and leeks. It filled up Joe's stomach and perked up Jen's feet. There was enough for every villager, and they all sighed as they patted their full bellies and said, "Imagine all that goodness from a single stone."
As we enter a time of extended silence for meditation, reflection, or prayer, as may be your tradition, let us give thought to these words from the poet Maya Stein. It looks like the sky is coming apart and together at the same time, and the body is holding its losses like a fist, and a fleshy hope is opening to an unprecedented vastness. And whatever we think we are leaving behind will keep insisting, and the things we desire will elude us. And our efforts will pose as failure, and we will not recognize how far we've come. And we will solve one problem and create another. And we will feel broken, and we will not be broken. And the silence will be deafening, and we will love destructively, and no one will appear to be listening. And there will be too many doors to choose from, and we will keep saying, "I don't know how to do this." And we will be more capable than we ever imagined.
In this year, terrible portents appeared over Northumbria and miserably frightened the inhabitants. These were exceptional flashes of lightning, and fiery dragons were seen flying in the air. A great famine soon followed these signs, and a little after that, in the same year, on 8 June, the harrying of the heathen miserably destroyed God's church in Lindisfarne. I read this excerpt in a college history class. I had come of age around the time of the new millennium. As a cheerfully superior atheist teen, I had found all the fuss about arbitrary numbers quite overblown. But when I read this terrible presentiment of doom from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, one of several medieval Christian sources which considered the advent of the Vikings to be the beginning of Armageddon, I did not feel contempt. I felt an understanding that has stuck with me now the details of Scandinavian land inheritance law and economic realities have faded. The chroniclers believed their world was ending, and I understood. My Vikings course began in September 2001. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Yeats. I have always been a contrarian, and I did not believe myself that the world was ending on September 11th, 2001, or even in the days that followed. But I did sense that a border had been crossed. The old world was now as inaccessible as a dream. War, hatred, and jingoism were unleashed, primal forces reshaping the world I had lived in and recognized. We're all familiar with that sense of irrevocability now, aren't we? Jokingly, many people refer to the world pre-COVID-19 as the before times. That, and jokes about the world without toilet paper, the zombie movie look of abandoned cities, I'll use an established cultural language that comes from my subculture, from science fiction. They're post-apocalyptic tropes, jokes about the end of the world. I was a child during the Cold War, as many of us were on one end or the other. It was a time ripe for post-apocalyptic imaginings. The age of the rocket and the splitting of the atom gave science fiction a huge infusion of creative energy, liftoff, and impetus to carry it to new worlds in magazines, novels, comic books, and the screen. Science fiction, I like to say, does sometimes predict the future, but it's also interested in preventing it. During the Cold War, the future to be prevented was obvious, the looming threat of nuclear war that could snuff all the infinite possibility ahead. I myself, more apparently than some kids my age did, understood the threat to be imminent at all times. I don't want to blame Madeleine L'Engle, but to me as a child, every day we stood at the teetering point of a swiftly tilting planet with no time-traveling genius to avert nuclear Armageddon. Armageddon. How easily those words come to mind and how absolute the idea they conjure, the end of the world. But even the cautionary science fiction bent on imagining the horrors after such a conflict, Andrew Norton's Daybreak 2250 AD, The Days of Perky Pat by Philip K. Dick, even the Terminator movies, mostly imagine a world that hasn't ended, but been poisoned, wounded, and profoundly changed. Part of this is merely, of course, that it's hard to write a story without a world, or even simply without people. It can be done. In their very different ways, the short stories There Will Come Soft Rains by Ray Bradbury and For a Breath I Tarry by Roger Zelazny tell beautiful, haunting stories of technology left behind by an extinct humankind. But mostly, even our darkest visions of a world after the world have living humans in them. The end of the world really means the end of peace, of civilization, laws, society. When we talk about the post-apocalyptic, we usually mean a world where limited resources are fought over by violent men, where the secrets of medicine are lost, and machinery is kept working but never made anew. Hobbes wrote in 1651 that without society and laws, the life of humans would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Much of our post-apocalyptic literature over 350 years later seems to agree. And why shouldn't it? It's a picture that serves many interests. First of all, it serves the interests of science fiction writers. These stories are high stakes, compelling, intense. It serves the interests of readers or viewers similarly, and also because these stories offer them the appealing simplicity of a world where complexity is stripped away, and simply being alive means you've won. But lastly, this view of the post-apocalypse serves the interests of those who traffic in the politics of fear, those who wish us to approve of their hoarding of resources for their benefit alone, those who believe that in a world of survival and violence, they would come out on top. The idea of a post-apocalyptic Earth as a violent wasteland is also a sort of frontier story, a wild, inimical landscape where one white man alone can extract what he needs to dominate. This is the kind of idea that makes the apocalypse popular with the violent, with accelerationists who believe a cataclysm in our society will allow them to establish their own. That is the idea behind the racist novel The Turner Diaries, which has inspired far-right killers from Timothy McVeigh to the present. It's also why the categories of post-apocalyptic and dystopian literature are often frustratingly conflated. Most of the grim authoritarian dystopias invented today have a disaster somewhere in their backstory. I'm by no means condemning the category of post-apocalyptic fiction. I enjoy reading and writing it. But I want to encourage us to question why we should believe a disaster will always lead to the breakdown of human ties. We believe, as you use, in the interdependent web of life. And we know a lone hero won't make a life worth living on his own. Apocalypse is from the Greek for uncovering. That seems a lot less final, doesn't it? And yet true to the feeling, the unsettled, teetering feeling of the monk who wrote the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, of a college student far from home the day the towers fell. The world is no longer what he thought, what I thought. Perhaps it never was. But the veil can't be drawn again. The picture has changed. As the poet Paul Eluard wrote, there is assuredly another world, but it is in this one. As I said in my first science fiction sermon, Rebecca Roanhorse and other Indigenous writers have pointed out that for most of the original inhabitants of the Americas, the world ended hundreds of years ago, and their societies have been living post-apocalyptically ever since. For my Irish ancestors, the world ended around 1845, and they had to find a new one across the ocean. The toll of disasters is long, the timeline of human life stretching back and back, people teetering on the precipice of pandemic and invasion, flood and famine, new realities completely divorced from what they knew. Because, as we have been told by imagined aliens in our literature, we are linear life forms. We can't go back to get something we left behind. We don't know what our futures hold. There are 1,000 personal worlds ending at this moment. More than 438,000 worlds have ended since the pandemic began, and so many more. The worlds each of those COVID-19 victims made and maintained and defined for the people who loved them. Only you know how many times your own world has ended. How many times you have put on your goggles and patched together your machinery and set out into the wasteland to see how you would survive. But here is the thing about disasters. We know, science has proven, that people are not rendered selfish, evil, and grasping by a disaster. Their first moments after a terrible thing occurs bring out the best in humankind. It's called disaster altruism. In the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, some called it the Oklahoma Standard. We don't have to, in Mr. Rogers' words to reassure children, look for the people who are helping. We are those people, almost all of us. We run towards our neighbors in need. We share what we scavenged. We help people out of the floodwaters. We form human chains. It's after the initial shock that sometimes we start to assess and become selfish. So when I say there are 1,000 worlds ending at this moment, one thing I'm saying is that I think we can find disaster altruism in ourselves on a day when our own world hasn't ended. We can use our great imaginations, and instead of envisioning ourselves as the lone hero, imagine how we can help and be helped. With COVID, with the unemployment and hunger it's brought, with the climate, with the next crisis that might come. The government says in case of earthquake, you should have at least 1 gallon of water per person for 2 weeks. I know people who maintain water supplies for their whole block in case of the big one. If you don't have room or water toting upper body strength to be the water neighbor, what else could you provide? Do you have land lying fallow that could be a community garden? Could you provide financial know-how or funds for a health co-op or a bail fund? Or a student loan jubilee. We can read science fiction that shows us societies completely different from ours, wonder at humans so totally without ownership in Le Guin's The Dispossessed that their language doesn't contain possessives. See a Quaker generation ship apply the Society of Friends values to space travel in Molly Gloss's The Dazzle of Day. And if we want to shape our future toward the utopian parts of these imaginings, we can start right now, today. Since we don't shape our world with violence, we don't need cataclysm to begin making it different and better now. We are already survivors, each of us, in many ways, and survivors need each other. Where must we go, we who wander this wasteland, in search of our better selves? George Miller, Mad Max Fury Road.
The sweep of the year brings us together.
As we extinguish the chalice marking the end of our time together today, let us resolve to carry within us the warm glow of its flame and all that it stands for. As we make our way through the coming week and all that it brings, let us be brave enough to be the light. And may we meet again in a spirit of peace, love, compassion, and health.